Okay, so this reading is taken from Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verses 1 to 6. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Frustration is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless.
So thanks for joining. And as Ian and Claire said, welcome, particularly if you are visiting. We're in the middle of a series from a book in the Bible called Ecclesiastes. And so far we've heard about the elusiveness of life, the fact that life is out of our control, but it is in God's control. And there's more to come in following weeks, because this is a series. But this week we're going to be focusing on chapter 7, verses 1 to 6. And the takeaway from it, spoiler alert, is that the wise way to live is to accept that you're going to die and to live life backwards in light of that certainty. Older Junior Church, great to have you here. Hopefully you've got your booklets with you, as Ian mentioned. I've got two main points in this talk. And my first one is this. It should be coming up on screen. The wise way to live is to accept that you're going to die. And I'd like you to look out for ways in which we pretend that we're not going to die. And I'd like you to answer this question. Why does the Bible say funeral is better than a party? Why does the Bible say a funeral is better than a party? Everyone together, let's look down. Let's start by looking at verse 2. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Let's chill out. This feels a bit heavy for a Sunday afternoon, doesn't it? I thought we were going to have something uplifting as I was preparing for this. We all know the phrase, was it something about death and taxes? But no need to dwell on the miserable and the morbid. The last thing we need to be reminded of is our mortality, right? Well, not according to the book of Ecclesiastes. This is how I think we need to unpack it. We can't escape the fact that this passage is all about dying. Verse 2, that we just read, is the anchor point of this little section from verses 1 to 6. The death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. This is, if you like, the center of gravity from which the rest of the verses, 1 to 6, discharge their proverbial darts. But why? Why this preoccupation with death? It just sounds morbid and weird and out of touch and boring and frankly miserable. Is this really how God wants himself to be known? Just how on earth is it better to go to a house of mourning, in other words, a funeral, a burial or a cremation, than it is to go to Pizza Express for a party, or maybe the Ivy in Clifton with a 50% discount, 5% VAT, Monday to Wednesday only, discount up to a maximum of £10, and terms and conditions apply. But what is so wrong with feasting? In fact, hang about, hasn't the author already said in chapter 2, verse 24, here we go, chapter 2, verse 24, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. There it is, black and white, double standards. No? The author isn't saying there's anything intrinsically wrong with feasting. It's better to go to a house of mourning, the author is saying, because we are so intent on, we are so committed to pushing the thought of death out of our minds. Death is inevitable for an inevitable event for me, for you, for the people you're sitting with right now, for your friends, the people you work with, your family. The wise thing to do is to acknowledge and accept that certainty. Death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Now, we might theoretically, in some sort of abstract way, acknowledge something about the certainty of death and taxes. But we don't want to accept it. We don't want to believe it. We don't want to be reminded of it. And we certainly don't want to dwell on it on a Sunday afternoon talk. But you see, to refuse to reckon with death is to refuse to live in reality. And that's really foolish, the author goes on to say. The living, and I think that encompasses everyone watching this on YouTube, should take this to heart. I might have a theoretical awareness of the concept of precipitation, and I might even know how weather forecasts work. If I'm planning a picnic, I might not want to accept that the weatherman said, despite the sunshine now, by midday, it's going to be 10 degrees with 100% chance of hail. Might not want to accept it, but to get on my push bike, cycle to the top of Dundry Hill in shorts and t-shirt, picnic in my backpack, proudly opening up my hamper at 11:45, would be to ignore reality and would be considered foolish. But beyond picnics on Dundry Hill, how does this apply? How does this challenge our worldview? I wonder what are the ways in which we, consciously or subconsciously, circumvent the reality of death? I think there are lots of ways. Been thinking about this over the course of the week, and I've just about got time to briefly consider two. Number one, advancements in medical science. And number two, YOLO culture. Now, if you're not hip and trendy like me, YOLO stands for you only live once. At least so I understand. But let me do the first one first. Advancements in medical science. Atul Gawande, I've almost certainly pronounced that wrong, is an American surgeon. He's a writer and a public health researcher. He wrote a book called Being Mortal. You see it? There it is. Being Mortal. And in it, he says, being mortal is about the struggle to cope with the limits set by biology. Medical science has given us remarkable power to push against these limits. And the potential value of this power was a central reason I became a doctor. But again and again, I have seen the damage we in medicine do when we fail to acknowledge that such power is finite and always will be. He goes on to say, and specifically relating to the treatment of terminal illness, our decision-making in medicine has failed so spectacularly that we have reached the part of actively inflicting harm on patients rather than confronting the subject of mortality. Rightly, we celebrate the amazing provision of our NHS in this country. We know that if we're sick, the chances are we can be treated. Some of us don't even have to wait for the NHS. Private medical insurance means we can get bumped up the queue and we'll probably get our own private hospital room. Here's a respected medical professional who, as far as I know, isn't a Christian, saying advancements in medical science can be dangerous in that they risk us circumventing the reality of death. Again, for death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. What about you only live once culture? I want to be careful here. It's easy to casually bash popular modern culture and feign intellectual superiority. The logical underlying premise of the phrase "you only live once" has to be that there is an endpoint. So if, as the popular saying goes, life is too short to wake up with regrets, there is, by definition, recognition of an endpoint. So in a sense, you see, you only live once, that culture does acknowledge the certainty of death. But it's nuanced. The trouble comes, I think, when we twist it slightly to say you only live once, so forget death. It's miserable to think about death. Live life for now, live life to the max. Don't worry about death. Don't even think about it. Thinking about death will somehow curtail your joy or limit your experience of life. And that's not what Ecclesiastes is telling us. In fact, Ecclesiastes tells us that YOLO culture isn't even new. Chapter 2, flip back with me, talks about someone who was wealthier than any of us. Chapter 2, verse 8, I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I became greater by far than anyone before me. This guy did the whole YOLO thing. Look with me at verse 10. I denied myself nothing, my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. Don't worry about death. And then in verse 11, with dismay, he says, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I came to realize the same fate awaits me as it does everyone else. It's really important, I underline, that the message here is not hashtag be miserable. The message isn't hashtag hate picnics. The message is the wise way to live is to listen to reality, to accept that you're going to die. It's foolish to ignore the certainty of death. Okay. So if it's foolish to ignore the certainty of death, what do we mean by my second point? Live life backwards in light of that certainty. What does living life backwards mean? We need to unpack that, and we're going to use three pictures the author paints in verses 1 to 6 to help us understand that only a proper perspective on death provides the true perspective on life. Older Junior Church, my second point is on the screen. I want you to look out for these three pictures and think, how do they give me a sense of perspective? How do they help give me a sense of perspective? Look down with me at verse 1. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It can be more helpfully translated as a good name is better than fine perfume. The day of death is better than the day of birth. But even then, how? Not because death is better than birth, but because the day of death is a better teacher than the day of birth. Metaphorically speaking, the coffin is a better teacher than the cot, because authentic reflection of someone's life says far more than the words you can meaningfully say about someone at birth. Don't get me wrong, the day of birth is incredible. A genuine wonder to be beheld. But what could I say? What could I teach specifically about Eva and Daisy when they were born? Beyond vague impressions of physical resemblance, and obviously the fact that they were the most beautiful babies ever born. Fast forward to present day, and I can look at them and I can say that they're kind, they're loving, they're determined, they're funny and full of all kinds of mischief. Fast forward 90 years from now, I hope that people will be saying, she was so like Jesus. She was so kind, so generous. What a depth there was to her as a person. I hope they're saying that rather than she loved her garden, or she loved her knitting, or she was immaculately turned out and she always smelled lovely. As a good name is better than fine perfume, the day of death is better than the day of birth. Author and leadership guru Franklin Covey puts it like this. He says, when you begin with the end in mind, you gain a different perspective. To begin with the end in mind means to start with a clear understanding of your destination. It means to know where you're going so that you better understand where you are now and so that the steps you take are always in the right direction. When I lived in Maidenhead, one of my favourite running routes took me around the Olympic rowing venue, Dorney Lake. And there was a big rectangular shaped lake. And as I stood at one end, catching my breath, I'd see at the head of each lane, these big metal triangles. These are my representations of big metal triangles. Can you see them? There we go. And I wondered what they were for. And then someone showed me, if you're in your boat at the other end of the lake and you're heading in the right direction, the triangles line up. It's quite difficult to do on screen. But there you go. The triangles line up. If you've got the right perspective on your destination, you've got the right perspective on life. As a good name is better than fine perfume, the day of death is better than the day of birth. The very biological limitation that death introduces into our life can instruct us about life. What about the picture in verse 3? Verse 3, frustration is better than laughter because a sad face is good for the heart. Really? How is a sad face good for the heart? Think again about that destination. The teacher thinks that seriousness accomplishes more than frivolity. Seriousness accomplishes more than frivolity. He's not against laughter. We've seen in previous chapters, he commends joy and satisfaction. Look at the verse with me. He doesn't say laughter is bad. He says, in the context of the fact that death is the destiny of everyone, frustration is better than laughter. A bit of frustration sharpens the mind to grapple with the great issues of life. At halftime of the big game, the team who has played foolishly and wasted opportunities doesn't get a talk from their coach saying, you know what, lads, you know what, ladies, don't worry about concentrating for the second half. In fact, should we get the beers in now? Just tell some jokes and have a bit of a laugh, shall we? On the contrary, the coach says, get your head in this game, Sonny. You feel that ache of defeat in your chest? You feel that regret creeping into you? Don't you even think about making a joke of it. You stare at it right between the eyes. You pick yourself up and you go back out there and you give it every serious effort you've got, right up until the final whistle. To keep us living life backwards, in perspective, the teacher says, frustration is better than laughter. Do we know what frustration looks like? COVID-19 is far from the only source of frustration, I'm sure. But having spent 15 weeks and counting in lockdown, I suspect we all have some idea of what frustration looks like. We heard earlier from the Hogs. Ecclesiastes tells us, do you know what? Frustration, better than laughter. Third and final picture. Verses 5 and 6. It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. The point about thorns under a pot is that they create a lot of sparks and noise and momentarily look impressive. But then they go. Thorns under a pot are like the song of fools. The fools say, ignore the certainty of death. If we live backwards, we understand that death is the destiny of everyone, and only a proper perspective on death provides the true perspective on life. The wise way to live is to accept that you're going to die. And as Christians, it is precisely that we don't need to fear death that we should be willing to talk about it and to think about it. There's so much more to say, but I've got to draw to a close. Next week, we're going to hear more from the same book. Let me leave you with one question to ponder. Which voice, which song are you going to listen to? The foolish or the wise?
Ed, lots of questions, lots of people voting for questions about how we strike the right balance between enjoying the life that God's given us now while appreciating the fact that one day we're going to die. How do we get that balance right? Do we spend our time worrying, thinking about death, or do we spend our time enjoying the now?
Thanks. Great question. And I don't think there's a sort of a metrically quantifiable answer to this question. But what I take from the passage is that in the context of the wider book, we are not to go around miserable. We are not to go around miserably thinking I'm gonna die. It could be any minute. But the message of this particular passage is really clear. It says we need to be thinking about the fact that we are going to die. We need to have that perspective. And I think what this passage in Ecclesiastes doesn't do, Ecclesiastes is before Jesus' death on the cross, so the passage itself doesn't have that wider context. We in the post-resurrection world, as Christians who know about Jesus' resurrection, can rejoice about the fact that Jesus, we are saved. But this passage tells us that we need to continually remind ourselves that we are going to die.
Yeah.
Does that help?
Yeah, I think it's easy to lose that perspective bit, isn't it? It's easy to think about now, harder to think about death. So thank you. Another question, again, really just headlines, please. But why do you think that so many Christians are still so anxious about death? The Bible tells us that death is, you know, death, life beyond death is good and better perhaps than living. How can we help our Christian brothers and sisters who are still really anxious about dying, maybe ourselves who are still really anxious about death and dying?
At a headline level, I think not talking about things breeds anxiety. Mm. And this is why the passage says we must consider death. The living should take death to heart. The living should take the fact that the death is the destiny of everyone. So I think the way to not be anxious is to talk about it, frankly. Our culture doesn't like that. Culture likes to avoid it. We need to talk about it, frankly, and be willing to talk about it. We don't need to fear death.
Yeah, great, thank you. And
that's too short an answer, but it's, if you'd like to come and talk afterwards, then please let me know.
Great, might be a good one to take to the small group later in the week, maybe. Thank you so much, Ed. Really grateful. We're going to hand over to Ian now, who's going to help us to pray some of this stuff in. Ian.